The Divorce Podcast.
Welcome to The Divorce Podcast, a podcast that aims to address divorce here in the UK, countering the often sensationalist way it's portrayed in the media, challenging the status quo, and hopefully driving reform. On each episode, I'm joined by experts to discuss divorce from different angles and to give their opinions and to debate them. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor and divorce coach, co-founder of Amicable, the divorce services company, and host of The Divorce Podcast. On this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by John Hind, director and founder of Compass Resolution. John is a mediator both in family and workplace matters, a non-practicing lawyer, family consultant, and group facilitator. He also trains people in mediation and conflict resolution. In short, a conflict resolution guru. Welcome, John.
Gosh, that's a lot to live up to, Kate. Welcome. Hello. Nice to be on your programme.
It's a pleasure to have you. John, I'd like to start by talking about the current divorce process in England and Wales. There are several different ways a couple or an individual can divorce and sort out either their financial or children arrangements. And like us, you support an approach that helps separating couples to communicate more effectively so they can make important decisions together when their relationship comes to an end. It just sounds like an ideal place to start. So why do you think so many people still use a lawyer or an adversarial approach?
Well, I mean, in essence, I think it's because the process of getting divorced, of separating and all that's involved in that is very scary. It engenders, I guess, all sorts of emotions and worries, anxieties and fears and anger and so on, and which kind of feeds into the need and the need to protect oneself. And what better to feel protected than go to a solicitor? So this kind of need to go and see a solicitor kind of feeds into this need to protect, I think. I mean, I've been a family lawyer, or was a family lawyer for many years. And, you know, the uppermost in most of my clients' minds when they came to me was, what can you do for me? Can you protect me? To what extent can you protect me? And so on. So I think it feeds into the anxiety that normally surrounds and fears and anxiety surrounds the whole divorce process. It can feel very scary.
So what advice would you give to somebody at the outset of the process then, if they need to have some courage in order to take an alternative path?
Well, if I could get hold of the person who's just going through a separation or about to start separating, pre-separation, and have that conversation really early on, I would say, having been a lawyer and a mediator for years, speak to a neutral person, someone who can explain all the different processes to you, who has no vested interest in you, who can help you and your former partner, the other person, to communicate, as you said, and to reach your own decisions. So someone who can explain all the processes to you, I think that's really important, and someone who is, I think, also important, who is neutral at an early stage.
Right. Do you think that's what's missing in our system at the moment, a sort of early triage type approach? Because it strikes me that people just go off in one direction or another, and that direction sort of depends on, you know, who they're talking to and whether their friends had a divorce and gone to this lawyer or done this or done that. And do you think if we had a better initial response to relationship breakdown, we would see better outcomes?
Yes, I mean, there is, of course, in place this the MIAN, the Mediation Information Assessment Meeting, which we may well discuss in a moment. But I think it's too late in the day. I think couples who are facing separation or separated ought to be encouraged, ought to be informed, ought to understand that they can, that mediation, for example, and the mediator is available to go and speak to. I see so many people who, as you say, have already been to solicitors, already partway down possibly the court process, have been with their sisters for many months and have already become quite entrenched by the time I see them, which makes my job as a mediator more difficult. So I think as early as possible, seeing the mediator. And the challenge, of course, is how do you encourage people to do that? I mean, at the moment, it is compulsory. It is compulsory if someone wants to make an application to the court for that person to go and see a mediator. I think there are many changes that could possibly be made to the current system to encourage people to go and and see a mediator early on to understand all the choices and all the possible options available to them, which is not currently happening.
And what do you think people need to know before they start out? So if you're just starting on a separation, what sort of information would you be expecting to get from your neutral advisor?
Well, my main message is that in most cases, most people I speak to, my main message is you can sort this out for yourselves with the right support at the right time. That's my main message. You know, my belief is in self-determination, in the ability people to make their own decisions. Most people are probably capable of it, but of course, they're in an unknown territory. So they need support and information and knowledge and emotional support and so on. So with the right support, I believe that most, you know, most people going through divorce can sort things out themselves. That's my main message, and that has always been my main message, even as a lawyer, actually. Our job as professionals then becomes, what do we need to do, each of us, to help this couple resolve things for themselves? Yeah, and that's my belief.
Right. And so a typical scenario, so like us, you work with couples, amicable is a couple's service. We often have people, as I'm sure you do, where you've got either a husband or a wife, or one partner or the other says, this is something I really want to do, it's something I believe in, but my wife / husband just isn't going to do this. What do you, or what can you say in that scenario or in that situation?
Well, I guess that if I were hearing what you just explained, what if the first person who wants to mediate is telling me that they want to mediate, but they're former partner or husband or wife doesn't want to, I would first be asking them, I guess, why they believe that the other person doesn't want to. So try to understand from the person I'm speaking to the barriers to the other person coming into mediation. But having listened to that, the most important thing I will say that I need to do is speak to, engage with that other person. So I might initially ask, you know, call them client A, the person who wants to mediate, help me, how am I going to approach, what's the best way to approach their former partner, and what is it they're most fearful or concerned about in terms of mediation, so that I know the barriers and understand the barriers and challenges that I'm going to need to help them overcome to come into a meeting with me. So that's the first stage. And also to remind both of them actually at this stage that really all I'm trying to do at this early stage is have a separate meeting with each of them, have a meeting with each of them that might not lead to mediation, but it's important for them both to understand the option, to fully understand, be fully informed, of course, about what mediation entails, what's involved, how I can help them. But yes, it is so often the case that if you like client B, the other person, that's where the challenge arises.
Well, is it that it's the other person, or is it that it's the first person's perception? Because there's a distinction there, isn't there?
Yes, good point. Yeah, absolutely. Perception is everything, of course. Yeah, because, of course, you're relying on that person, the Corbin client, the person I'm speaking to. You're relying on them to convey their experience. And it is just their experience, their perception, their experience. When I speak to the other person, client B, I might have invariably, actually, interestingly, I often have a completely different experience and completely different conversation than I was led to believe I might have. Absolutely, yeah. So often the challenge is, then how do I approach the other person? You know, is it by email? Do I just pick up the phone? And there's lots of different ways of doing that, of approaching the other person to ensure that maximum engagement.
And typically, what are the best approaches then? Because is there a GDPR issue in all of this as well? Are you allowed just to go and cold call somebody who hasn't specifically asked you for information or anything?
The law allows, in terms of mediation, in terms of mediation process, the law allows a client A, if you like, to provide contact details for client B so that the mediator can contact them. I find the best approach often, and it really depends on circumstances, the best approach is to send the other person, client B, if you like, a letter or an email, more likely an email nowadays, to say that I would like to explain that what they're being invited to, which is just an opportunity to have a chat with me about mediation and to explore and look at whether mediation might be the right process for them both, and then to give them a few days to think about and to look at the email and think about perhaps giving me a call. And very often they do actually give me a call. I'd say 80%, 90% of people, when they receive that email, give me a call. And sometimes they say, gosh, I've been wanting to mediate for a long time, or whatever it might be. And then we have a conversation, an initial conversation, before I arrange my AM or my mediation information meeting with them. So I tend to find it's very successful, actually. Most client Bs want to have a conversation with me and explain their story, their narrative, and find out what I can do to help them.
What sort of cases? So let's just say you've got talked to partner A, you're talking to partner B. What sort of issues would they be raising for you to feel that mediation wasn't suitable? What are the red flags, if you will?
Well, I guess the typical red flags in the cases of unsuitability may be extreme power imbalances in terms of abusive behaviours, patterns of abuse, rather than isolated events, so psychological abuse, coercive control, and so on. So if there's a narrative or a story from party A or client A of a pattern or history of abuse, then that would be a big red flag. When I was exploring with client A their ability or willingness to look at party B's perspective and explore what they might be looking for, in other words, a second perspective, and they're struggling, really struggling to do that, well, there's a large degree of what I call self-delusion. It's just a very, very one-sided narrative, or maybe very peppered with anger, blame, punishment, and so on. That might be another red flag, and so on. And obviously, child safety issues, where social services may be involved, or other organisations like police may be involved, and so on. That may be unsuitable, but not so necessarily. It doesn't always necessarily mean, it's really black and white. Bearing in mind, of course, I can see people in separate rooms, I can see them online, and given, of course, what are their options? If it's not mediation, what is that? What is their option? Court? I don't know. So, yeah, those are the kind of red flags.
And generally speaking, then, it sounds like that there are large swathes of people who would be suitable for mediation, given that, like you say, it's not just a black and white. You know, we hear about tick lists and checklists of whether you're suitable or not suitable. It sounds like there's a much greater degree of flexibility and discretion available to a negotiated or mediated approach than perhaps people might think. And so what sort of numbers are we talking about in terms of suitability for mediation? What's your view?
Yeah, my view, I guess I just, this is more anecdotal. I guess it's just based on, I don't know, 22 years of doing this work. I'd say 70%. Thereabouts, 70% of people are suitable for mediation. And if I were to take a broad brush stroke of all those people I've seen in the last, I don't know, couple of decades, I'd say, generally speaking, I would, or in reverse, probably 30%, I would think, no, really, mediation would not be the right place for them.
So that's quite a powerful statistic, isn't it? If we could get a message out there that the likelihood of you being suitable for mediation is high, is 70%, that I think is very persuasive. Because I think mediation suffers from a bit of a bad reputation, and I can't really understand why, because it feels like such a no-brainer on so many levels.
No, I can tell you why I think it's because so many people, when they consider mediation, have in mind a picture of what mediation is that it isn't. So, you know, I might typically get, oh, I can't sit in the same room as him or her, because that's what they think is required, necessary. And so I think when people may take a view or have a view about whether mediation might be suitable, they have in mind their experience of the other person, the quality of their communication. I can't speak to them. They haven't accepted what I want. So what makes you think you can change their minds? That kind of language. So they find it very difficult to understand the concept of what we're doing in mediation. And also the fact that mediation, the process and how we set up can look in, can have many different forms as well.
Have you found an increase in the use of online mediation in recent times? I mean, presumably with COVID, absolutely, you must be doing all of your mediation online.
Yeah, well, at the moment, the last couple of months, all my mediation, pretty much every day online for mediations or doing the pre-mediation meetings. Prior to that, I would fairly regularly use online where couples may have had a disability, means they can't leave home, or they're abroad internationally. So maybe a father is coming across to London or whatever to see the child, his children, and I need to kind of set up some kind of communication channel between him and the mother, or her and the mother, and the husband. There are many reasons why online might be quite useful. Some people just like the fact that it's distant, it creates a distance between them. So I think we may well see an increase in use of online after COVID. People realise that it is it's quite a useful process, actually, way of doing it.
Do you think there are specific challenges with online mediation?
Yeah, well, mainly in the, what you're missing in terms of body language and sort of the level of communication. So it's quite a large it requires quite a big adaption, if you like, to mediating. So typically, if I've got two people on a screen, I might be looking into the camera to ensure they feel I'm looking at them. And I might miss a nod or hear or crossing arms or all sorts of body language, a twitch of the face. So I might miss some negative and positive body language. But having said that, conversely, my focus and all my energy then is on listening to the words they're using, the representational systems, if you like, the meaning of words and nuances, the language. So what I might lose in other body language, I'm kind of gaining in the listening, the empathic, the active listening. So pros and cons, yeah.
And just thinking a little bit more about, so you've got person A and person B to agree that mediation is a potentially a good option. You've met with them, you've got their backstories. What sort of help can you give them once they're in the room and actively mediating? What sort of strategies do you use to get them from a process of disagreement to a process of agreement? What does the mediator do in that scenario?
Well, I can say what I do. I mean, it's quite a big question because obviously it's quite a few things, but in terms of skills and strategies and so on. But I can tell you broadly the kind of approach I might take just from maybe the last few weeks of mediations, but I have a fairly kind of structured approach. So I might begin by asking why they're there, to make sure that they, or to get a sense of their commitment and their good intent, the intent there that's the motivation, the degree of motivation for them being there, to ensure that we're all there to work together and try to maintain a solution for this kind of attention and to reach outcomes that ultimately meet enough of each person's things that they each hold important as important. So I can ask them a bit about what we call building an agenda, a sense of why they're there. I'll then focus, and I'm being generic here because it depends on whether it's a financial one or a child or child arrangements, but whichever it is, I'll focus on what their priorities are in terms of the outcomes that we're going to be working towards. So I have this kind of obviously notion of begin with the end in mind. It's very solution focused. So I might use the metaphor, okay, we're in the kitchen together, we'll bake a cake together, but we need to agree the ingredients are going to go into this cake to ensure that once it's baked, it comes out of the oven, it's going to be palatable enough. So what by that I mean, when I say to them both, I'm interested in what your priorities are in terms of outcome. Is it you're looking to remain in the home? Is it you're looking for more security in terms of income? Whatever it might be. Is it, so we build a kind of a toolbox of priorities, that if you like, their values, what's important to them and why it's important. And I will make sure that's written down and we all see it. And that anchors us into the next stage, which is to begin constructing solutions or outcomes which factor in as many of those priorities as possible. And the reason why I do this is because often people come in, especially they come in from the legal process with positions. You know, the legal system talks about position statements. And so I try to help them immediately off those positions and start, if you like, from the ground up, looking at values and interests and needs. And then once we've got that, then I begin by saying, okay, what would be really helpful to do is now to begin to look at some ideas, some options, some child arrangements, financial options that might factor in some of those things that you said were important to each of you. And when I ask you to do that, could you also please consider why whatever option you come up with might be appealing to the other person? So I'm constantly kind of reminding you to work in the first and second and possibly third, I'm children's perspectives and so on. And then we begin the process of building options and reality testing and so on. So it's quite structured, quite a kind of, especially with online. And I will explain the kind of structure I'm going to use before we even begin and the kind of approach, so they have an idea of what's expected of them. And so it is really keeping them focused on solutions, on their priorities, on their values, the things that are important to them, and trying to keep them away from the negative narratives, the things that often hijack the process, things that keep popping up.
So how do you do that? So let's, because this is a common thing as well, isn't it? So there'll be outbursts, or there'll be people, you'll think you're getting somewhere and then somebody will go and throw the old typical grenade in of, well, we're nearly there, but just remember that you did this to me, or whatever the particular grenade of choice is. How do you deal with somebody who is one step forward and two steps back?
Yeah, so if there is a lot of emotional kind of reactive kind of, if you like, reactions in the room or in the space, in the online space, I'm getting someone who is really finding it difficult to self-manage, to self-restraint, self-regulate, whatever you want to call it. The first thing that needs to happen, that absolutely needs to happen, is an acknowledgement of what I'm sensing, seeing, hearing, noticing, so on, the emotion. You know, I can see, Sheila, this is really, you know, this is a challenging process. I can see the anger, the frustration. And, you know, rather than just let that go, I think this is what I then do. I see the emotion expression as an indicator of some need that is not being met in that moment. So if it's a trigger of, let's say, Sheila is not feeling that the point she's making is being heard, and that just triggers something because that's been a pattern of their relationship. He's, you know, Bill never hears her, he talks to her, whatever it might be. I might say to her, look, I'm seeing a lot of frustration, anger. I think it might help us at this moment to stop, to pause, and to look at what might be driving this kind of reaction, because it's been happening over the last half an hour again and again. And my concern for you both is that if this keeps happening, mediation is not going to work for you. So would it be worth spending 5 minutes to uncover, just get explore a little bit of what might be happening there, what that kind of anger, that frustration, those expressions of anger and so on, might be covering in terms of needs that are not being met, like lack of appreciation, lack of hearing, worrying about not getting a house, whatever it might be. Because, and this is the other key strategy that I kind of use, and it's quite effective, it is this building this mutual understanding, helping them both to understand so that they can then acknowledge with each other what they're hearing and the emotions that are being expressed. Because often I often find that this is the first time that each person is acknowledging and is enabled to acknowledge what they're seeing and what they're hearing from the other person, and to reassure them that's not what they meant, and this is, and they would like to work with them to see where they can help them and so on.
So it sounds like there's a lot of emotional management. So there's, you've got your tools, you've got your strategies, you've got your process, and you've got your emotional management all coming together in one process in order to help people retain some control, to be able to express how they feel, to be able to prioritize their wants and needs, and to ultimately get to a solution that works for the children and both of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Building their, if you like, in the therapist might say, building their agency, their sense of empowerment, their ability, to make joint decisions and so on.
And it strikes me that that's one of the biggest, most fundamental benefits of doing a process like either our negotiation process or a mediation process, where you are actually leaving people in a better state and more able to continue, for example, on a co-parenting journey, or continue their own personal development out of the breakdown of the relationship and into their new life. That to me seems like the biggest value that this kind of joint couples process can possibly give.
And isn't that so important? That's, you know, the nail on the head there, really. And often couples I'm working with, and this is something almost every mediation remind of, don't forget the value of sorting this out for yourselves, of improving communication, of the, if you like, the spin-offs of doing this together in terms of ongoing relationships, going to children's weddings, grandchildren's, and all those other aspects that are so important, and sometimes more important, actually, that are often forgotten.
Yeah. But it strikes me that with the no-fault divorce bill as well, that there will be a better platform to start from, because when you investigate a divorce, if you start to think that you've got to go down the route of blaming or it being a sort of an attritional approach to sorting things out, if we get no-fault divorce, one of the kind of less talked about benefits is, for the first time, you'll be able to do a couple's divorce. So you'll be able to jointly petition effectively. And so if the government pathway starts with a joint decision to divorce, then the mediated approach, the couple service approach, seems like it will have a much better opportunity to show itself and to demonstrate itself than before.
Absolutely. You've got a great anchor, a great priming tool, if you've got a no-fault starting point, haven't you, compared with a starting point which relies on pretty much on fault, on positions, on and it can be quite divisive. So absolutely, it'll be such an improved platform which to base a process like mediation, which is based on conversation, discussion, mutual respect, mutual decision-making, joint decision-making, respect each other's values, and so on. So, you know, let's have it quickly, government, please. Let's get on and have it. It's been on the cards for a long time.
It has, and it feels like an endless wait at the moment with everything possible thwarting it with COVID and everything else, but fingers crossed. Just finally then, John, because we're sort of approaching the end of our time, just finally, you mentioned at the beginning that there were things you would like to change about the mediation system. So we have no-fault divorce coming in. What else would you change in order to get everything aligned and this to be a much better approach? It's not that it needs to be a better approach, I suppose it's a much more, an approach that's taken up more. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, wouldn't it be great if, for example, I'm just thinking on my feet here, actually on my bum, wouldn't it be nice, it, as part of the divorce process, maybe in the divorce petition itself, there'd be a box or a tick box saying, or requiring or encouraging maybe, a conversation or a meeting with a mediator at that stage, rather than at the point at which, just before you're going to make an application to court, which is too late. Because by that stage, there may have a lot of water maybe under the bridge before you make an application to the court. So at that stage, maybe an earlier stage, maybe at the petition stage. And also, what about requiring at the moment that the client A, the applicant is required, or the petitioner might be required to attend a mediation information meeting? What about also requiring the respondent, the other person, the party B we start off talking about, rather than me having to persuade and engage and exercise all the skills, why not require them to find out, to make informed decisions? And I think that would help a great deal as well.
That's great. John, that's all we've got time for. The time has flown by. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you and to find out more about mediation. How can people find out more about you? Are you on Twitter? Do you have a website? What's the best place?
I'd say the best starting point is the website. We have various social channels, but the website is probably the best place to start, which is www.compass, normal spelling, C-O-M-P-A-S, -resolution.co.uk. And there's quite a lot of information. And there is so much information on that website. I think there are about 120 videos, 10 different online series to help people go through the divorce, the financial arrangements and the child arrangements themselves. Using a mediator, so there's an awful lot there. If they'd like to have a look, and if they've got any questions, just speak to me or one of our mediators. That'd be great. And thank you very, very much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure, Kate. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you, John. You can find out more about Amicable at www.amicable.io, or you can follow me on Twitter at Kate_Daly, or you can follow the Divorce Podcast at Divorce_Podcast. Thank you for listening.